All right, we're recording, and I'm going to ask you to sign the deed of gift form, which means you're giving this as a gift for educational purposes to UT Arlington.
Education is the best equalizer that we have in our society. Education gives you knowledge, and knowledge gives you power. So I'm going to write it for you. That's why I'm doing this as a gift.
All right. And then at the bottom, if you'll put a mailing address, we'll send you a copy of the videotape here in a week or so. And then much later, we'll send you the transcript.
Okay.
It's unedited. And anything you want to add in terms of paper documents, because it is an archive, would be most welcome and appreciated.
I have a lot of boxes of documents.
813. Mm-hmm. Well, if no university has asked you to put your papers at their place, we have the labor archives, basically, in UT Arlington. Glad to have your papers. Whatever you want to send. Paper documents, photographs, clippings, campaign material, press releases.
I got a lot of notebooks. I'll be back to make copies.
Okay.
And
great.
And gift them all to the university.
Great. All right. What is leadership?
Leadership is being able to lead and do what's right for the public. Do what you think in your conscience is the right thing to do, and not buckle to pressure. And I guess it deals with power and money, and give up on your principles and beliefs.
Who is the most effective Mexican-American leader today?
Well, let me first say that leadership also means that you must be able to take certain risk, calculated risk, and not be afraid. And I always go back to a very favorite saying of mine, that I didn't say it, but Emiliano Zapata said it. That I'd rather die than live on my knees. And I think it's very, very something I got taught very early in my youth by my parents. But it also helped in the United States Marine Corps, where I served in Vietnam as a squad leader. Because I was afraid many times, but I was not afraid to die and lead my squad into combat. Now, who is the most effective leader today nowadays? Hispanic?
Mexican American.
You know, I don't think there's any one leader that stands out right now. We have a whole group of leaders, Hispanic leaders, Mexican leaders throughout the country, from Gonzalo Barrientos to myself, you know, to Lieutenant Governor of California, Bustamante, who's running now for governor. Our leadership is somewhat dispersed, but in a way that's good, because we are leaders in our own right in our communities. But to have one person stand out, we don't have one. I don't see that person. At one time it was Henry Cisneros, and he had some unfortunate personal situation that derailed him. But I think he could come back if he wanted to. But I don't see any nationwide leader that leads the Hispanic community.
Which is the most effective Mexican-American political organization?
I think also it's a combination of groups. You have La Raza out of Washington, D.C., with Raul Izaguirre. You have LULAC, who is not as active as it used to be, where Ruben Munia was its leader. You have different caucuses, Mexican-American caucus in the legislature, the Senate Hispanic caucus. You have, the GA Forum. But in terms of which group is the most effective? That's a difficult answer. That's a difficult question to answer, because our power in terms of effectiveness is forming coalitions with different Hispanic groups and Black groups, and some of the other community-oriented organizations.
What is the most pressing issue facing Mexican Americans today?
Well, you know, I would say. An off-the-cuff remark, but I guess I better not. But the reality is education. We need to focus on education, and education is just so important, because it gives us knowledge, and knowledge gives us power. It really empowers us. But one of the things to think about is this. Right now, the Democrats complain about Hispanics voting Republican, the Hispanics are educated, and they benefited from affirmative action. They benefited from civil rights marches. They benefited from democratic sacrifices to get Hispanics educated. It is true. But then they complain because you get a Hispanic who buys a second-use Mercedes, and now they think they're Republicans. But the reality is this. I don't think that if a Hispanic wants to be a Republican, so be it. I don't blame that person. I blame the party. Because we are in a market of competition of ideas, trying to influence the masses. And if we cannot attract Hispanics as a party, as a Democratic Party, then it's our fault. It's not the person who goes and becomes a Republican. And I think we need to make a stronger effort to articulate our issues. And I'll give you an example. We need to keep close to our base, to our principles and beliefs, and not try to imitate the Republicans. I'm talking about the Democratic Party. Because the Democratic Party sometimes forgets where it came from, forgets its grassroots support, and tries to be too conservative on issues that are important to the not only to the Hispanic community, but to the working families of our country.
Well, so education being your first answer right away, you mean education in a very broad sense, not formal education per se?
No, in a broad sense. You don't have to go to college to be an educated person. My father dropped out of the fifth grade, but let's not confuse education with intelligence. And you have a lot of people who are self-educated, a lot of people who have a lot of skills to offer in terms of the job market, our economy. So I look at education in a broader sense, and not having a degree, a college degree.
Well, you mentioned your father. Let's talk about your family biography. Father, grandfather, mother, grandmothers, where did they come from, when, why? Your family, your brothers, sisters, your wife, your family, your children.
Well, let's talk about
who are you?
I'm just a poor cotton picker from South Texas.
That's from Ramstown. That's from Ramstown.
Well, let me tell you, it's very interesting because my mom is from La Escondida, Nuevo León. La Escondida, Nuevo León. Un ranchito up by Monterrey. She was here in this country as a wetback. That's what we used to call them when I was young. Now they're called undocumented workers. That's what they used to call us at that time. So she came over here illegally. We crossed the river, and I was born here in the United States. She married my father, Juan de Dios Hinojosa, who was a Tejano, Hispanic Tejano. My grandfather and great-grandfather on my dad's side, my father's side, are Hispanic, but were born in Texas. My mother's side, they all come from Mexico. And we worked in the fields when I was a kid. When I was 5 years old, my mother was here illegally, was deported by the Border Patrol. They caught me and her and my oldest brother, my brother next to me. And I'm a U.S. citizen, and they deported us in a paddy wagon back to Mexico without even telling my father. It took him a week to find us and locate us. And we lived behind a beer joint, a bar, in Mexico, in Reynosa, for a year, before my father could get her the proper documentation to make her a legal resident. So my earliest experience was La Migra, the Border Patrol. But my father and mother always stressed education. And in those days, we didn't have bilingual education. But my teachers, and I remember them, Mrs. Suter, Mrs. Siegel, Mr. Rodriguez, Mrs. Cavazos, for beginners on, would speak Spanish in the classroom. I mean, they would teach me that they would say manzana or apple, manzana, pear, pera. So we had, in a sense, an informal bilingual education program in place. And as I grew up through my, I come from a large family. I come from a family of 11. I'm the oldest. And we, quite frankly, used to pick cotton, tomato, carrots, onions, sandias, melones, citrus. And every summer we go up north to work and come back, always in time to start school because my father was very insistent that we get an education and we finish school. And in school, I was very lucky that I had teachers who were very much interested in education. As a matter of fact, Jose Angel, your wife, Gloria, and her family, she's one of my best friends, and her family were a great family that I grew up with. Through high school, and I'm sure that we talk about teachers willing to stay after class to teach people like me the difference between the CH and the SH sound. And I like sports, so I got involved in sports. It was also very helpful to me because I had coaches that were very disciplined and taught me about know, about getting exercise, about being tough, and about being able to focus on certain assignments. But when I was in high school, there were some difficulties. There's no doubt that City of Mission, the tracks separated the Anglo community from the Hispanic community. And I always wondered how come the Anglos had much nicer houses than us Hispanics. Even their callejones were paved. our streets, even main streets, were not paved. Crystal Water Swimming Pool Admission, you were Hispanic, you could have swim there. We have the Manhattan Cafe, they didn't allow Mexicans to eat there. There's certain discrimination that I grew up with, which slowly but surely disappeared. And it disappeared the generation after generation gets better in terms of doing away with discrimination. But they didn't keep my teachers, both Anglo and Hispanics, are being committed to education in the Mission Elementary or the Mission School System. So we had very good teachers. We had Kenneth White as a superintendent, Cortland Wright, and we used to get together and study together as a group. So that's how we benefited from that.
Not to make you have an embarrassing moment, but the only name you provided was your father. Can you give us the names of your mother, your grandparents, and your brothers, sisters, names?
My mother's name is Esperanza Vela. She's still alive. My father died at the age of 52 from cancer. And he was a truck driver for Havana Materials, Mr. Bodine. My father, just to give you a little bit of history of my father, because it's very important. The truck drivers were organizing because they were not happy with the pay. My father, being the foreman, became the spokesperson for them. Well, guess what? He got fired. He had to move to San Antonio, away from his family, for at least a year. So he worked driving a truck during the day and fixing flats at a Shamrock service station during the night. My mother used to work out in the fields with us, and then she stopped. You know, somebody had to do all the cooking and washing, take care of the house. My mother is from Los Corrientes, where I said a while ago, Esperanza Vela. My brothers, I have Gilberto, Javier, Juanito. I have Martin. My sisters are Sylvia, Janie. I have Irma, another sister, another half-brother, Mimi. And my grandfathers, my grandfather on my dad's side was Juan de Dios, you know, also just like my dad. And on my mother's side, Carmen Vela. And we always used to call him Papa Chiquito on my dad's side. On my mom's side, just Abuelito. And we used to go and travel up to Mexico and stay at the ranch sometimes with the family. Very interesting.
What was his name? Abuelito.
Abuelito was Carmen.
I thought that was the grandmother.
No, it's my grandfather.
Okay.
My grandmother's name on my mother's side was Rosa. Okay. Rosa Carmen Vela.
So you visit the Vela clan in Mexico often?
Oh yes, we used to visit them often and almost on a regular basis. On my father's side, Papa Grande, you know, that's what we used to call him, and Papa Chiquito. But Papa Grande was actually my great grandfather.
What's his name?
We used to call him just Mora was part of his last name. Hinojosa, but we used to call him just Papa Grande.
Okay.
So sometimes.
Papa Grande, Mora Hinojosa.
Yeah. You ask me this name, so impromptu, and I can't remember.
No, sometimes, I know. Sometimes it's very embarrassing for almost everybody I interview. Yeah.
But we used to go up to Raymondville and Lubbock. I used to go up to Robstown to work in the fields.
Oh, so you were an in-state migrant?
No, we also migrated to Illinois.
How long did you do that?
Esparago. But then what we found out was that in Illinois, because they had a union shop, that you got paid very high wages. You join a union and planted sod on the expressways, that's grass, or the airport, or O'Hare Airport. So we started instead working in that type of work, because we could make about $300, $400 a week, which at that time was a lot of money.
Well, when were you born?
I was born in 1946.
And what are you, on the 11 children, where are you?
I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest?
I'm the oldest, and the first one to go to college. Get a degree and then go to law school.
Well, how did first you get out of high school with a migrant work and all those kids? And I guess your mother was a stay-at-home mom except for the summer work.
Yeah, you know, we my childhood days in high school were great. I had a lot of fun. I mean, I played football, basketball. It was a very pleasant, positive experience for me in high school. I never thought about having that I had to work such long hours. It didn't do anything to me. I just thought it was just normal. I know there were some bullies. I'll tell you one time I got beat up with this guy. This is such a story. When I was a kid, I was selling monitor, or at least a paper, out in the streets. I got beat up by this guy, and another friend intervened, who was
big old over your money, or just because?
Just because.
You were out there selling paper.
And
te creías mucho.
Yeah, and se te era muy chingón.
One of those attitudes.
Yeah, and believe it or not, he was an Anglo kid who's pretty strong. He can cut him off me. And it's interesting because that's when I really got interested in doing exercise, building myself up, just at least to defend myself. But one of the key ingredients that besides my mom and my dad, that would help me stay in school was sports. And my teachers were always very pleasant. One of the key teachers that made me into an A student from about a C plus to B was Mrs. Wolfram.
How do you spell it?
Wolfram. Wolfram. Wolfrum.
Okay.
Era una señora ya viejita, pero de mucho respeto. And as a matter of fact, Gloria also, we took classes with her together. And a very, very respected teacher. Well, she made me from a C plus B student to an A student. And those people encouraged me to stay in school.
Was this the day of homeroom teacher where she was everything, or did you rotate?
Yeah, we rotated.
What did she teach then?
English.
English?
Yes. We had Mr. Rodriguez, and we still had Rod Rodriguez to teach math. Mrs. Cavazos used to teach social studies. Mrs. Suter used to teach, I think it was English or spelling. We used to rotate classes. The other thing is Mission was really a small community. So we knew each other very well, and the other day we interacted very well with the Anglo-Hispanic and what have you, to the point that after school was over, go back home to respect the community. There was at the time that we would exchange. We would bring maybe tacos, frijoles, arroz, and what have you to school for lunch. And the gringos would bring sandwiches, so we would exchange. We would eat their sandwiches, they would eat our tacos. Talk about having to merge and have mingle our cultures.
What about those segregated parades and queens and things that I read about still in Mission? What were your thoughts then, or what did you see? Did you participate? The churches? Were you an altar boy? Were you in Little League, Boy Scout?
Well, I used to go to catechism a lot until they asked me to leave, because I would ask so many questions. I said, you don't have faith? Well, I said, I do have faith, but how do you answer these questions? And they wouldn't answer for me, so I pretty much didn't continue with catechism. But
there's two churches. The one that the priest has a dog that attends mass, and then the other church, by Gloria's house.
That's right. I used to go to the one in Guadalupe on Dorothy Street. Or
that's the one with the priest and the dog in the
that's
mass?
That's right.
Okay. Is that the Mexican church?
Yes, that was a Mexican church.
Okay. Is there a Mexican cemetery in
yes,
Mission?
Yes.
And what other cemeteries?
Well, the cemeteries were for Hispanics and no dejaban a los mexicanos to be buried in the cemeteries where the gringos were buried. But that's changed since then. It's amazing, but it's so different now. I always tell people that we're no different than the gringos, you know, and I'll give you a story in a little while how I got the money for the rack. Because in reality, where our culture may be different, we're all Americanized when you go to school. And we all want good jobs, when our family is safe, when criminals are behind bars, and we want a nice house, a nice car, and for our kids to get a good education. And when you start learning that our goals in many ways are the same, you have to respect each other's culture and differences. And that I like arroz con frijoles, and maybe you like something else that's different. I mean, I like steaks too, just like I'm sure that someone like rice and beans. So, but it's a learning process. That at that time, the generations that were in control sort of looked at us like, separate but equal. And really, it wasn't even equal. But as we get educated, as we learn more about each other, you find that, hey, we're all Americans. We're here to, this is our country.
Well, tell me about why did you decide to go to college, and who planted that seed, or when did you know that you wanted to be a lawyer? All this got interrupted with Vietnam, no?
Well, actually, you know, when I was in high school, they used to try to channel the Hispanics to vocational programs. They didn't encourage us to go to college, but I wanted to go to college, and of course, I wanted to be a lawyer when I became a senior. And some of my friends would laugh at me jokingly. Said, "Chinga Chuy, you can't even speak English. How are you gonna go to college?"
Well, where did this come from?
I don't know. I'm not sure, but I guess from TV and stuff that I read, and I like politics and what was going on, I got interested in it. Well, then it was very interesting because I was bored with school. I went to Pan American for one semester. I got offered several scholarships to play football.
What year was it?
1965. Because I would play quarterback for the football team. I was captain of the football team, captain of the basketball team. And then I wanted to be, I was bored with college. I didn't take any of the scholarships. When I played football, I cracked one of my ribs, and I said, yeah, I just want to study. Well, but I saw all my friends been going to Vietnam, so I decided to volunteer. I was not drafted. I volunteered to join the United States Marine Corps to go to Vietnam. Yes, you know, so I knew I made a mistake my first day in boot camp. And I was there, and they slapped me around and put your feet, there's this yellow marked feet in the cement. And I said, oh my God, what did I do? So I said, oh Lord, please let me wake up tomorrow morning, let all this be a dream and be back with my mama and hot tortillas and rice and beans. But the reality was that I was in the United States Marine Corps, and it was tough. I always remember when my dad and my mom took me to the Continental bus station there in McAllen. They put me in the bus, and the guy was sad. But I went to Vietnam and spent 14 months. It made me a better person. I learned a lot about life, and the United States Marine Corps really taught me a lot about survival, about leadership, and there I was. I spent 14 months in Vietnam. So when I came back, I was very motivated. I mean, after being in Vietnam in combat, a lot of my friends, like Terry Langford, that kid. I can't pronounce his name. Bonuelos, Bill Bonuelos got killed. A lot of my good friends were killed or wounded. So I came back, you know, and I was very motivated. It took me 2.5 years to graduate from American University with honors. I went straight through summer school. I was unloading mail trucks at night, $35 a week, and I felt very strong about it. But I knew I wanted to go to law school. And I wanted to go to the University of Texas, except that the University of Texas discriminated against Hispanics at that time. They only had about 5 Hispanics. You had to be the quote-unquote the right Hispanic. to the point that one of my very good friends, George Young Jr. from Harlingen, wanted to go to law school at the University of Texas. But I had a higher GPA than he did. I had a higher LSAT score than he did. He got accepted at UT. I got rejected. He wanted to go to Georgetown, one of the top 10 law schools in the country, Washington, D.C. He applied, he got rejected because of his grades. I got accepted because of my grades. he was so upset that UT rejected me, he went to the University of Houston Law School. And then I think he joined the Navy. Can we take a very short break?
Sure. Yeah. Oops. All right. Well, we were on the Vietnam stuff, and I guess the college, going to law school, you went to Georgetown. You know, you obviously you don't have visibly the lasting effects of Vietnam that others complain about. I'm sure you have opinion, but right now we ain't got time. And I'm sure you have a lot of comment about going to law school in Georgetown. But we don't have time for that either. So,
I'll come back.
The component is missing is your political career. Yeah. So I don't know if you can do this in 5 minutes, but you don't have to hurry. You've got time. We can come back and do some more later.
I'd rather do it and come back later because it's very interesting how I got involved in politics. I always talk that people should not be afraid, and we should ought to run for public office. We need to participate in the political system. If we do not, we'll get left behind. This is why we have right now a shortage, what I consider, qualified candidates running for a higher office in the Hispanic community. We need more people to participate. And I stay away from negative people because the no-sayers will never get anything done. If I believe people tell me, well, you'll never be a lawyer, you'll never go to college, you'll never be anybody successful, then I wouldn't be where I am now. When I ran for public office initially, I like politics. and I was driving to Corpus Christi, as a matter of fact. I used to work for legal aid after I graduated from law school. And I filled that gap in a minute, but this is important. Cullen Looney, at that time, was the state representative.
Spell the last name?
Cullen Looney, L-O-O-N-E-Y.
Okay.
Leo Montalvo, who right now is the city, or the mayor of the city of McAllen, ran against Cullen Looney as a Raza Unida candidate, and he lost. Well, Cullen Looney family is very wealthy. They're ranchers. And he decided to retire at a very young age, because, you know, he really didn't care for the kind of politics. And they were grooming Eddie La Garza to run for Cullen Looney's seat.
Is this Kika's son?
Kika's grandson.
Grandson.
And I said, well, you know, I want to run for that seat. And I had worked on campaigns before then, on John Hill's campaign, so I knew all the basics, you know, all the in the trenches type of nitty-gritty stuff to put together a campaign. Well, I decided to run. I still remember. There used to be an overpass of a railroad on the way to Valfurrias. And that's when I said, you know what, I'm going to run. So I started making phone calls. That is what I wanted to do. I didn't get any support from the powers to be. I figured that I represented Edinburgh, Mission, McAllen, made up of the district, that I would be a good candidate. But I didn't get much support. And I guess, well, I'll finish.
I'm recording.
Okay. But, you know, I always like politics. I enjoy politics. I think for people to have a voice, you need to participate. You have to have the energy and the drive and the ganas to do things. When I ran for the first time I had to run for public office was for state rep. They came open all of a sudden when Cullen Looney decided to retire. He was very wealthy, comes from a very wealthy family. And I didn't hesitate at all. I thought about it, said, this is what I want to do, and I ran.
What year was this?
1980. And it was Matias, Murillo Matias, a JP, and Eddie La Garza, the grandson of Kika La Garza, congressman, and myself. Well, I was the odd man out, so to speak. Nobody knew who I was, even though I've been assistant attorney general for 2.5 years, three and a half years, filing lawsuits against corrupt and fraudulent businesses under John Hill. So I was trained, and my mentor was really John Hill in terms of campaigning and organizing door-to-door, telephone banks, getting the message out and trying to influence the minds of the masses, so to speak. I didn't get any support. I went to visit with a powers to be, quote unquote. It's very interesting. They knew who I was, but they said, no, we decided to anoint Eddie La Garza.
Well, who were these powers to be?
Well, there were people who were in public office, they were wealthy people, who were loyal to the Kika de la Garza clan, wanted a conservative Hispanic there. They thought I was too liberal. So I said, well, you know, I come from Peñitas. That's part, the western part of the district where I was running. I graduated from high school in Mission, and I now live in McAllen, and I went to college at UT, University of Texas Pan American, in Edinburgh. So I said, I got covered. I got all my bases covered. I said, no, we can't support you. You don't have any money. It was true. So what I did, excuse me for this, it's just my lips get very dry up here in New Mexico.
It's very dry here as opposed to the valley.
Very dry. So I said, okay. So I got my friends, Dr. Bill Beaker, who I served or was a member of the JCs at McAllen. A lot of my friends from high school, like Gloria Garza, my wife, Linda, Oscar Alvarez, my family, all my sisters and brothers, and I filed. And we walked every single house from Sullivan City, the western part of the county, to Don Carlos Ranch, San Carlos Ranch, on the western part of the district. My brother got bitten by a dog, but we worked very hard, and I made the runoff against Eddie La Garza. Very interesting because he outspent him about 3 or 4 times than what I spent. And my campaign was pura raza, pura gente. working family issues. And I'll never forget this incident. We were at this dance hall. The sheriff, Brickman Malejo, was also running. Beto Salinas, who's the mayor of Mission, at that time was running for county commissioner against Ortegon, Dr. Ortegon, who just passed away recently. And I forgot the other gentleman who was in the race. In that race, I was at a dance hall in Edinburgh, and Sheriff Brickman Malejo was having a big pachanga. The pachangas, you know, they had a music and the whole works, and they let you dance, and then during the break, you would all the political speak. And my opponent said, ¿Cuál Hinojosa? Anda en las campañas, no, con puro borracho, en las cantinas. Which is true. Not kind of borrachos, but I campaigned a lot in the bars. Peñitas, La Grulla, Madero, los barrios. Because working families, the truck drivers, people work in the fields, la gente de trabajo. When they finish, they go to the bars, have a beer or two, play a little pool hall, then go home. They were not drunks. My turn came up to speak. I said, ¿Por qué cuando un mexicano, uno de la raza, va a una cantina, toma una cerveza fría, dicen borracho? Pero cuando es gringo, a country club, scotch and water, y social drinking. ¿Están borrachos? ¡No! Estaba todo ya bien, feeling good and happy. I mean, I knew, when I said that, everybody just exploded. I knew I'd won that race. Go put a working down. So man, he made a big mistake there. And I went on to win. And when I won, it was very interesting also because it was a very hard-fought campaign where he relied and depended on the accomplishments of his uncle, Kiko de la Garza. And I spoke and said, I depend on what I've done, who I represent, and where I come from. So I mean, I won the race. And for that, I came to Austin. I never been to a state capitol. As a matter of fact, a good friend of mine, you probably know him, Moreno, Representative Moreno from Edinburgh, came in a second time. So drove up to the Capitol, an old pickup, con los colchones and everything. We didn't know any better. We parked right in front of the Capitol. So the Chicanos there, El Luna, friends of mine now, you know, and some of his friends from Houston were passing by. They saw the pickup con los colchones todos del valle. Yeah, I don't know del valle. Excuse me. It was so interesting. Because it's true, Yaganos del Valle. We had a certain reputation, and this is very important because it's true. When we came in, the Mexican-American caucus was very weak. They were not well organized, and they focused only on civil rights. And the other thing is that at that time, they only allow you to have, Bill Clinton was the Speaker of the House. They would only allow you one bill to bring up to the House floor for debate. Talk about undemocratic procedures. I selected to take the bill for the farm workers to provide them with workers' compensation. I took on the Farm Bureau. I will not go into the details, but I will tell you this. We organized the caucus to stop focusing on just civil rights, on Chicano issues. Let's focus on all the issues that impact our families. So we put a staff together and focus on banking, agriculture, oil and gas, education, health, economic development. We took it on. Initially, we have a press conference on a regular basis at the state capitol. Nobody would show up. But they started paying attention, slowly but surely. Boom! We became the most effective caucus, Mexican-American caucus, to bring about change in the legislature. We demanded appointments. We demanded that our issues be heard to the point that it changed the whole image of the Mexican-American community. I mean, we were the shock troops, if you will. We were not afraid to do anything. I will tell you that Hightower, when he was Commissioner of Agriculture, we tried to really screw him on chemical skills by language. They really tried to take advantage and take away his budget, and they cut his budget in half. They took away all his power to regulate chemicals in the cotton fields and in agriculture. But I formed a coalition with the blacks, and some of the progressive liberals from the cities, suburbs. So we stopped the appropriation process. I remember the speaker calling me to his private room, and one of the other representatives who was on the Republican side started yelling at me. What are you doing? You got the votes, you're gonna kill the whole budget. I said, I'm not, you are. Look what you're doing to Commissioner, to Hightower. It was very interesting, because he got this real close to me and just yelled at me. You know, you got big breath, please move away. and we won the fight. They backed off and gave us the money back to Hightower and killed the bill that was going to take its authority to regulate the use of chemicals, where usually farm workers are the ones that get hurt by that. They would spray fields where the farm workers were still out there picking cotton, picking tomatoes or carrots. And then I went on to deal with family issues, family violence, to the point that, you know, the old cliche about, you know, they tried to bring me in and make me a chairman. They made me chairman of the Committee on Criminal Jurisprudence. Then they made me chairman of the Committee on Local Consent. Then after I became chairman, they changed the whole rules because I figured out the whole process, how to get bills passed through all the rules. That I got named top 10, the first Hispanic to be named top 10, one of the top 10 legislators in the state of Texas. And I got named again, twice. But all this time, in the legislature, I was not interested in being a Democrat or Republican. I was interested on issues based on merit. I didn't care if you were a Republican. You had an idea that helped who I represent, fine, give you credit. And the most thing, the thing that is most important in this type of situations is your word. Who are you? Who do you represent? Tienes corazón, or tienes palabra, or you're just a politician can be bought off just like that. And I still remember, this is how reputations are made. I got up there and we were doing redistricting, my very first session. So there's a big fight over a district, House district up in Dallas. The gentleman's name was Frank, I can't remember his name, I can't remember right now. He was state rep, but the Republican wanted him out. I didn't know the guy. I knew he was pretty liberal. So Democrats wanted him in. But he voted against workers' comp for farm workers, for my folks back in South Texas. The Republicans asked me to vote with them, and I did. This is a non-issue for us. And guess what? I was the vote that made the difference and killed this district. When it happened, the Democrats, not all the Democrats, it was a mix at that time. They asked for verification, and because a lot of Democrats voted with the Republicans. And they asked for verification. And I remember Barrientos, Gonzalo, my good friend Gonzalo Barrientos, Craig Washington, Johnny Bryan, Ron Coleman out of El Paso. They all came to my desk and said, take a walk. Why am I going to take a walk? Leave the floor. I'm not going to do that. Change your vote. I'm going to do that. Why not? Hey, I gave him my word. I was going to work with him. I'm sticking to it. All the Republicans were about 2-3 desks away, just like this, watching. After that, they left me alone. So on key issues helping the farm workers, the Republicans would always work with them and change the laws to benefit farm workers. So it was an interesting experience for me. God, my lips are real dry up here. Since then, I've always been very successful in passing legislation, bringing about more money to the Valley, South Texas, creating a medical school, creating an engineering school at Pan American, expanding the educational opportunities for South Texas, bringing about more money in terms of economic development, junior colleges, did all that through the process. But I learned the rules and to work with different folks. The legislature historically is bipartisan. You look at issues based on merit. It's only recently that we turned very partisan. But it's been the type of situation where I became chairman of the Mexican American Caucus. Now I'm chairman of the Senate Hispanic Caucus. But one of the things is that to be effective, you have to stand for something. You have to have certain beliefs. You can't just put your finger to the air, you know, and move whichever way. And if you believe in something, certain principles, certain issues, you stand your ground. Now, when the caucus became very effective, we sort of diversified, so to speak, on the issues. We went to the back, Mike took on the establishment. We blew them out of the water because we did the research. We were prepared. We had the bullets. We didn't go there and say, raza, raza, this and that. It had already been done before and helped us to where we are. Now it was the time to move on and start dealing with key issues that impacted everybody. So we gained a lot of respect when we go out there embarrassed an establishment guy or gal and the front mic, and we for the back mic asking questions and wipe them out. We had press conferences, boom, 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 and we used the facts. That's the way it was. Very successful. Then I quit. I was going broke. The job doesn't pay. We get paid, I would clear less than $100 a month. This is how the corporations and the wealthy people control politics. And I left. I was in debt almost close to $1 million. It took me about 3 years to pay it off. In the meantime, I got appointed to the coordinating board by Governor Richards. But I still left politics. So I paid off my debts in 3 years. I decided to run again.
When did you quit and when did you run again?
In 1991, I left office. People were very disappointed, wanted me to run for Congress, do this. I didn't want to go to Congress. Texas, where the action is, not in Washington, D.C. So I came, I really didn't want to run for Congress. And I was happy being on the coordinating board, my law practice, being with my family. And something happened. We needed a medical school in the Valley. They couldn't get it done. Tried once, couldn't do it. Tried twice, couldn't do it. And Eddie Lagarza, as a matter of fact, ran for my post. And Eddie was a good legislator, but he got some personal problems that I want to go into. So I got sort of persuaded to run, to get the medical school done. And I did. I ran against Eddie Lagarza, an incumbent, and beat him again. I beat him, and I'll leave it at that. So I came back with the sole purpose of getting the medical school. My first session back, I got it. And it was an uphill battle. First time I met with Dr. Cunningham, he was the Texas president, to give him what my idea was. So I sat down, see, I understand politics. He said, Dr. Cunningham, let's get one thing straight. I don't work for you, you work for me. I work for the people. I got upset. That's what the Constitution says. Got up, was a little bit upset. Came back. Dr. Cunningham, I just didn't get out the water in our truck. Let's get it straight. Okay, this is what we need. We need a medical school in the Valley. He refused. He said, no. He said, you know, Dr. Cunningham, let me tell you. I says, Tyler, Texas has one. The Valley is bigger than Tyler. McAllen is bigger than Tyler. I said, Lubbock has one. The Valley is bigger than Lubbock. Midland, Odessa has one. Why not us in the Valley? Because we're Hispanic, we're Mexicans. Well, I can't do it. I use his own numbers, the own research from his own University of Texas folks. I said, well, okay, I'm going to go after you. Sure enough, 3 weeks were just blasted away in the press until he came back and says, can we have dinner? I said, sure. We had dinner at a country club somewhere in Northwest Boston. I don't know where it is.
And a social drink.
And a social drink. No borracho, man. And guess what? He agreed to help. To his credit, Dr. Cunningham went all out. I mean, he was tremendous help in getting us the RAC. It was called the RAC in the Valley. It was an uphill battle.
RAC is an acronym for?
Regional Academic Health Center. But it's really a medical school. They start out and it becomes a full medical facility. But it takes about 8 to 10 years to develop a medical school. And that's the money that right now Governor Perry is withholding. So we got it going. We had to jump through all loops and hoops. A lot of support from grassroots. And at the end, we lost it. Janelle took it off. Janelle was chairman of appropriations. And I will never forget this because I know what the rules are. This is why it's so important to understand the rules. I asked Janelle, what's wrong? What's the problem? We got the coordinating board to. The coordinating board initially rejected the idea. I said, they got thumbs down. And Senator Carlos Truan and all the delegation, we were together. Senator Eddie Lucio was one of the leading fighters in the Senate. Well, the press leaked out that the staff for the coordinating board was going to recommend a no. Well, the next day, when we appeared before the coordinating board, we asked them, are you just going to rubber stamp what the staff says? You got to make your own independent judgment. Oh, we got it. So they said yes. At the end, when we lost the coordinating board, when we lost the money, I was very upset. So I called Chairman Janelle and said, Rob, you know, I want a conference committee. What for? I want a conference committee. What the rule says, if I can call for one. He gave me, in the Senate, we knew we had the votes. In the House, he gave me 3 Republicans, 2 Democrats. One of them was Irma Rangel, who very nice person, tremendous leader from South Texas. She chaired the Committee on Education. And Henry Cuellar out of Laredo. And 3 Republicans. Well, the 3 R's was with them, or so he thought. So Buddy West from Midland, Odessa. I knew that I may be able to persuade him. So I said, Buddy, can I talk to you? Sure. I said, Buddy, let me tell you. I mean, I really need this medical school in the Valley. We really need it. We have a lot of health problems, and we're growing very fast. Other parts of the state haven't. And besides, Buddy, let me tell you something. Our families in the Valley are no different than your families in Midland, Odessa. We want good homes. We want good jobs, good schools. We want criminals behind bars. And we also like good music, cold beer, and loose women. I mean, he broke out laughing, gave me a high five, you chew, you're all right. It's just a connection. And I don't mean to disparage women, you know, but just give it as an example. He identified and bonded with me so quick, and boom, $55 million. Janelle was very upset and went and talked to him. You can't do that. You know, we can't go ahead. I gave Chewy my word. So we got the medical school. Unbelievable. This is why I say that we people in Texas have a lot of things in common. There are people who try to divide us. They try to divide us based on race or even economics. But I always say that, you know, there are a lot of poor farm boys in West Texas need just as much help as a lot of poor Hispanic families in South Texas. And I want to help them just as much. After that, you know, I guess I got named chairman again, the Committee on Criminal Jurisprudence, and dealt with a very serious problem in Tulia, where they arrested all those black folks on drug stings that were set up by an undercover agent who was a criminal. And I pushed for legislation to provide for cooperation of evidence in drug cases. I worked with ACLU, and again, I got named top 10. There's a whole bunch of bills that I introduced, and there's so many that, you know, take me an hour to go through each one of them. And then, I mean, I was tired, you know, because I had this for a long time, and I don't make any money. I lose about $250,000 a year doing this, but I don't do it for the money. You always see the commercial, you know, for example, that how much is this worth, how much is that worth, and how much is being the Texas 11 worth. It's priceless. We're making history. I was thinking of just not running again. I served 6 years in the House my second time around. Just wanted to stop. It's a pretty grueling schedule. A lot of wear and tear on our bodies. I think sometimes I joke that if I started eating healthy, my body would go into shock. So I get used to all, you know, tacos de barbacoa, fajitas, I don't know, pachangas, drinking beer and whatever. All of a sudden, I knew Senator Truan. He was an icon in South Texas, fighting for families, one of the top senators. But I heard rumors he wanted to retire, but I wasn't sure. But he was taking a good friend of mine, Vilma Luna, around to South Texas, to the Valley, so I had some suspicions there. I'm not going to impugn his integrity. He's just a very good senator. history will mark him as one of the best who fought for the people. I decided to run for the Senate. Jose Rodriguez from El Paso, who went to law school with me, who is now the county attorney, asked, well, did you sit up? Steering committee? No, man, went to a pachanga over there in San Taquito, decided, hey, let's go. And I decided to run for the Texas Senate. And Carlos, and I called Carlos Truan, my good friend, and he retired the same day. Well, he didn't retire. He decided not to seek re-election as soon as I told him I was going to run for his post. He'd been there a long time, 37, he was dean of the Senate. Like anything else, you always need to need new blood coming in all the time. So I decided to run. I thought I was going to get a free ride, but there are no free rides in politics, my friend. So what happened is that all of a sudden I had this lady, Barbara Canales Black, run against me. I didn't know who she was. But I did my research very quickly. And Diana Martinez, who was the head of the Democratic Party in Nueces County. I later find out that Barbara Canales Black is a multimillionaire. The daughter of Tony Canales, who never held public office. She's got a law degree, very beautiful lady, very intelligent, very articulate. And we are, all of a sudden, you know, she's spending money left and right. I don't have any money. As a matter of fact, there's a consultant by the name of Bill Miller out of Boston that did me a big favor. There was a front page story in the Monitor. They said, you know, one of the horses is not serious about the Senate race. He's broke, doesn't have any money. Well, everything is relative. I spent about $75,000. I think Barbara spent about $200,000. Diana didn't have any money either, but they were after me because they knew I was the main person in the contest. I mean, they really trashed me. The front page of my hometown newspaper in the morning. By 2 o'clock that afternoon, gente de trabajo coming in. Corito, quitan 20. Than 100. I mean, talk about pumping me up. For them, $20 is a lot of money. Workers, trabajadores. I've been there now serving them for pretty close to 25, 26 years. They know who I am. It was such I felt so humble que la gente de trabajo would give me the $20, $50. I mean, I was just like, wow. And then I got a call from the man himself, you know, Glenn Roney. Richest man in South Texas. He owns Texas State Bank.
What's his last name?
Glenn Roney. R-O-N-E-Y. Roney. He owns Texas State Bank. Chewy, I want to have a luncheon for you this Friday. I'm in my bank. So, it's a fight they want, it's a fight they're going to get. So I go up there to a luncheon. I knew half of the people that were there. There were 15, 20 people. And they knew what it was. 10,000, 15,000, 20,000, 5,000. I came out there with $250,000. Let's get it on. It was a very tough fight for me because the toughest campaign I've been involved in. See, I was taking on a legacy. They were using Dr. Hector P. Garcia. She's the granddaughter of Dr. Hector P. Garcia. His legacy against me. Frijolero del Valle is what he used to call me in Corpus Christi. But I went up there and I spent almost 75% of my time in Corpus Christi. She spent about $3 million. I spent $1.2 million that I didn't have. It's a very hard campaign, and there are so many issues involved. But I continue to hammer on the issues that impact working families, la gente de trabajo, las familias, educación. You know, talk about wages, talk about health care, education. This lady, while she was very smart and articulate, she really done nothing in her life in terms of compared to what I've done. And she again did the same tactic that Eddie LaGarza used by saying, I got connections, I have money. She had connections, I got money. And this is what my uncle or my grandfather had to be that serious done. He said, this is what I've done. And I had a litany of accomplishments. But it was so the most difficult race because the money she was spending was just outrageous. But they continued to make a lot of mistakes. They're very arrogant in their campaign, very arrogant. When I campaign, I always campaign in my hat. Okay? I used to pick cotton, and I worked in the fields picking tomato, onions. I always wear a hat. When I campaign, I always wear a hat. Well, it's not proper, I don't wear my hat. But I've been wearing hats since I was 5 years old. And I got about 15, 20 hats. For us in the valley, and I only had a slice of the valley, the western part of Hidalgo County, McAllen, Farr, Edinburgh, to Stark County, to the county line. I didn't have all the valley. I had Brooks County, about 4 years. I had Jim Wells, Alice, and Fremont, and then Oasis County, Corpus Christi. And it was a very interesting race because traditionally, historically, todo tiempo, Corpus Christi is seen as the big city. And they've always beaten the valley. I took him on, and I beat him. They make so many technical mistakes because they were so arrogant in their campaign. With all due respect, Tony, there was a debate that took place. Tony Canales was debating one of my key people up in Corpus Christi in the radio show, talk show. He called us gentucha, gente corriente, de trabajo, los compran dos por mil. My family. I got so upset that this is on the debate in the radio. We taped it and I ran it on the radio so people could hear the way they think, what they thought, how arrogant they were. Instead of saying, you know, I apologize, it came out wrong, that's not what I meant, they bought every single radio spot from Laredo to Corpus South, every 15 minutes, calling me mentiroso. I mean, just trash me and my family. I resent it very much, Tony, and your family. I got over it to a certain extent, but we won. Very, very, very tough campaign. At 6 o'clock in the morning, my whole family, when they started attacking my family, we just work harder. 6 o'clock in the morning, I started in Corpus Christi. I never forget this. I knew I had won the race then.
This is election day?
Election day, 6 o'clock in the morning. Están los carros lineados. Puro carro viejo, raza. And I worked the polls with my head on. And so many people saw me. Chuy, 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 gentucha, 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 chuy, chuy, chuy. Huh? I mean, you know, when the gente wants to come out, man, we came out and kicked butt. I went back my stuff was gone.
So it was a hard-fought campaign and you won?
Yeah,
what was the margin of victory?
I won by about 15,000 votes.
No November opponent?
No, I didn't have an opponent in the general election. But it was a tough campaign because people had so much money. They knew no bounds. They thought that money could buy votes. They thought that the legacy of Dr. Héctor B. García. And when I was in Corpus Christi, they called me the Frijolero del Valle. But we showed them that we in South Texas, the Valley, had earned the right to be the leaders of South Texas. Corpus Christi is that behind. And guess what? I'm very humbled when I'm in Corpus Christi. I stay at their hotel. Can't even remember the name right now, but that's where I stay there all the time. And when I go have dinner at the hotel, up at the top floor, I look at about 14, 15 skyscrapers. Huge city, beautiful city. And I'm humbled and honored that I represent Corpus Christi. Corpus Christi, my base there is very strong. The supporters that supported Barbara Canales Black, and also Diana supported me in the runoff, had come over to support me because I was showing leadership. I've become a leader for them, trying to get them to push and expand their economy. I've settled some of the most difficult problems they had in terms of politics. They have too many factions. I don't get involved in factions. I deal with public policy and issues. I don't get involved with petty stuff. Otherwise, it just bogs you down. I look at public policy, what's in the best interest of the community. I was able to do that, to resolve some of the most difficult issues, because I came in as an outsider, so to speak, and I looked at issues based on public policy, and that helped a lot. So people in Corpus Christi are very happy with me. If an election was held today and I had an opponent, I probably got about 65% of the vote there. I mean, I won them over by hard work, by showing leadership, tackling difficult issues. I'm not in this for my personal gain, anything like that. My victory was a very sweet victory, because my whole family was insulted. And my law office, when I won, was packed to the gills. And my dad just came. I danced with my mom. She's 81 years old. Cantaron la favorita canción de la raza. Con dinero y sin dinero, mi palabra la ley, dedicada para Barbara Canales Black. I had my hand and I danced with my mom. My mom was super happy. It took Barbara Canales Black about 3 days to concede. And then she still didn't quit. She says, I'm going to be watching you. Well, good. Maybe you'll learn something. And I'm not vindictive, you know. And I called Barbara and, you know, asked her to help on the issue that important to Corpus Christi and move on. But it's a campaign that I will never forget. But, you know, I spent 5 months campaigning for this office. Five months, 7 days a week, from 6 in the morning to 1 in the morning. Because the people that I thought were my friends at the Corpus said I didn't have the energy, nor the drive, nor the money. Well, let me tell you, I got the energy, the drive, maybe not the money.
Well, but you eventually got some. Yeah.
So it was a tough campaign, and I was very happy, because I think that being a senator is a new experience for me. In the Senate, I joke about coming in at a time when the Republicans taken over. Governor Dewhurst was a very excellent leader during the regular session. That's fair, even him. Now, you know, he's changed to a certain extent. He's become a very partisan, pretty much misrepresented a lot of stuff to the senators, and he's become almost loyal to the Republican Party at the expense of Senate tradition and protecting the Senate as an institution. But, you know, as a freshman senator, sometimes you got a little bit cautious, you know, because you don't know where all the traps are. I am now, I did very well from feedback that I get in resolving and bringing in more money for the Valley at a time when we were very short of money in the state budget.
How does the Senate work differ than the House work with your experience so far?
Well, I always joke about this, you know, and the Senate is like a barroom brawl. The House is like a barroom brawl. The 150 Senate, 150 House members. So it's very difficult to know each one very closely, very personally, very well. And so you're up in the front mic presenting the bill. The back mic, anybody can go up there and ask you questions. They'll throw you curveballs, fastballs. You better be ready. Some will throw you softballs and help you out. But it's a no holds barred type of debate. And I love them. That's where I learned my stuff. But see, when I was in Georgetown, Washington, D.C., I organized the 6 law schools over there. And I got named president of La Raza Law Student Association. So I got a background about all this stuff. On the Senate, it's more collegial. We get to know each other. We're all 31 senators, so we know each other very well, sometimes too well. We know our families. We know our background. We know our emotions, to the point that we hold hands, you know, kissy, 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 hug each other and go, thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator. It's a very different institution. You know? I mean, people will respect each other. And I say that because, you know, it's like somebody telling you to go to hell in a very nice way. And you smile about it. You get run over, you smile about it. It's just it's a great institution. We try to protect each other. We work with each other. So I don't, there's a difference. The debates are more gentleman-like type of debates. Sometimes you cut, you know, but they're not as cutting and where you draw blood like in the House. And we try to protect each other. Unfortunately, the only exception is redistricting. I mean, that is gloves off, knuckle fight, no prisoners taken. that's where we're in right now, with the Texas 11 here.
Somebody once said that a political crisis is a moral crisis, really. And do you see the Republicans becoming a white party and the Democrats becoming a minority party, and a crisis not only in the state but across the nation, between the haves and the have-nots? And
what is happening color? Is this. Yes. Let me tell you something. The Republicans want Hispanics to become Republicans. They reach out to us. Yet they cut education for us, for Hispanics and working families. They cut health care for Hispanics and working families, which in many ways are the same. The needs are the same. They cut Medicaid for working families. They cut funds for prenatal health care for working families. To the point, the Republican Party speaks a forked tongue, so to speak. Their action speaks louder than words. They don't deliver on what they say. They don't take care of working families. They don't take care of minorities. They're trying to get rid of the few Anglo Democrats that are left, even though they're conservative. Because what they're trying to push, and I truly believe this, their agenda is to eliminate all white Democrats so that the Democratic Party will be nothing but blacks and Hispanics. That's my take on it. For example, in Texas right now, that's what they're trying to do, get rid of the conservative Democrats who are in Congress right now by again changing the lines. And you know, we used to do this every 10 years after the census is taken. Now the Republicans are being very aggressive, which is not good public policy. It's not good for the nation as a whole to change congressional lines every time that either party takes control of state house and the legislature. It creates a lot of divisiveness, a lot of hostility, and then the focus then is on raw power and not dealing with the real issues that impact families.
Let me ask you about a couple of issues. I know one you were very successful in, and that was the battered women's defense.
Oh, yes.
Battered women's syndrome defense. You want to talk a little bit about that? The other thing I want to ask you is the toxic dump in Mission that's causing a lot of problems there with those people.
You know, when we grow up and we're young, we talk about machismo and being a macho and being a man. And sometimes we really, there's too much family violence. Instead of talking things out, discussing them, we get this type of situation where we beat up the wife, which is that shouldn't be the case. You know, after Vietnam, I was involved in hand-to-hand combat in Vietnam. I was a squad leader. I lost all my desire to be violent or have any type of stuff or whatever. In the better women's syndrome, that's the key issue, because if a man and a woman, if a man is beating up on a woman, the woman usually cannot defend herself because the guy is physically stronger and bigger and can kill her. Well, women, what they were doing is that after they got beaten 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 times, they got fed up. When the guy was sleeping, they would kill him. And they would go to the penitentiary for 10, 20, 30 years. And to me, that was unfair. Because under the self-defense law says, it's gotta happen in the heat of the moment. So in other words, if you draw a gun on me, I have a gun, you gotta shoot me, and I shoot you, self-defense. You come with me, or you come at me with a knife, and you gotta kill me, and I'll draw my gun and shoot you, self-defense. But now, a woman can't do that. They cannot react immediately unless they have a gun. So most of the time they don't. And even when they have a gun, usually the man will overpower them. So that they were going to jail in the hundreds. Because I went to visit the jails in Texas. They were full of women who had killed their husbands. There were a lot of them who had killed their husbands. Of course, after they had been beaten up again and again. I always thought that was unfair. So we passed the Better Women's Syndrome defense for women, so that you could prove through documented reports written by police officers you were beaten again and again physically, sometimes to a pulp, by your husband, or your boyfriend, that if you killed them, there would be a jury issue. So the jury issue believed you. You killed him in self-defense. You found that guilty. Of course, I got a lot of death threats about that. I still have the tapes. where guys were threatening to kill me. I said, why'd you do that? You stupid, give license to kill. I didn't believe that. Well, don't beat up on your wife. You don't have to worry about that. So it was a big issue for me, to the point that I defended the first one in the Valley, using the Better Women Syndrome, before it became law. And Sanchez was her last name, Hebron Farr. And she was Donna, Far Isle Madonna area. And she used to be beaten up almost every weekend. And the guy would grab her by hair and drag her across the floor in front of their children and their mother and father. And finally she got enough, and this on an Easter weekend, he again comes by and he drinks a lot, he was drinking a lot, and said that he's gonna come and see her the next day. She knew she was gonna get beaten up. There was the pattern. And she asked him for some money for to buy some dresses on Easter Sunday for the girls, separate Easter Sunday weekend. And what happens is that instead of buying dresses for the girl, she gets a gun. Asks the guy how to shoot it. The guy shows him. I don't know if she bought it. Like twins, probably. So she goes looking for the guy Saturday night before he comes home to beat her up. And he comes out. He's coming out of a bar. With a girl, the barmaid, and another guy. And then she points a gun at him. The guy doesn't believe her. And he said, get in the car. That's what he tells her. So he gets in the car. She sits in the car. She's got the gun pointed at him. The lady that was with him takes off, so does the other guy. He lunges at her and she shoots him 8 times. And got her off from just the probation. But I was able to show all the abuse, physical abuse she took all these years. And from then on, that's when I decided to introduce that legislation. Mm-hmm. The other one is, and Judy Seferini also helped me a lot with that piece of legislation, because she finally got it passed with the governor, and Richard signed it into law. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that I passed for women, for protection of family, really. You get angry, upset at your wife, just walk off, come back in a little while, go drink a beer or whatever, or just go watch a movie, but don't use violence. It's just not right. You talk about the chemical stuff, hay salmons. That is a very serious situation where we used to live about 3 blocks away from hay salmons. It's a chemical company, or actually it's a chemical plant. We have all the chemical companies ship through the railroad all kind of fertilizers, all kind of poison, all kind of chemicals for harvesting. And it pretty much contaminated the whole area. The people now who live in that area, within the, the infected area, started dying of cancer at a much higher rate than any other place. They have boils, and there was huge raw, what do you call those, they were fester. Just unbelievable. We have all the pictures, and we have, there's lawsuits. I have several clients that we have a lawsuit against chemical companies. We call in the state to come in and try to clean up. They're trying to do their best. Not good enough, in my opinion. And as a matter of fact, Celia Munoz had a home that she didn't know that the hay salmon plant people were dumping chemicals into her backyard. Sort of like a dump, if you will. And then when she was going to sell the place, and they found out that they couldn't sell it because it was contaminated with all kind of chemicals, poisonous chemicals. Cause cancer, kill people, infect people, the name of the they keep changing the name of the name of the agency, state agency, that comes in and cleans up the chemicals that they find. Well, they came in and cleaned it up and sent her a bill for $1.2 million. I'm serious. I mean, we were so upset about it. We harassed them and tell them you can't do this, and they refused to listen to us. Well, this session, we got it done. We did the legislation to go after them. And then they got it done. And then they said, I mean, they got it done. They got it cleaned up, but they took out the lien of $1.2 million. And they said, well, did you do this because of pressure from the politicians and state senator and state reps? Oh, no, we did it on our own. I was so furious. I called him and said, hey, are you telling me that all the calls we made were for nothing? that we hadn't called you down on your own. I want to know who said that and come and report to me, or they apologize profusely. Yeah, because they were, again, they were just playing games with people. But anyway, that's still ongoing litigation on that. Not with Celia Munoz, but with the people who lived around the Hay Samos area. They've been infected and have cancer. And we have the experts who established that it was caused by the chemical that were stored in the area. And also, a lot of the kids when we were young used to play around Hay Samos. They would have mounds of chemicals just sitting outside. We didn't know any better. Go out and play out there. I'm one of the few that never went to play there because my dad wouldn't let me. But it is true. It is a big problem.
Well, we left off two things earlier. I don't know if you want to get into it if you have time, but we know you went to Vietnam and you've made references to that, but you didn't discuss your experience. You also went to Georgetown Law School, and you didn't discuss that except you mentioned that you organized some places. No, I don't have any other questions. Whatever it is you want to talk about,
I would not go into the details of Vietnam. It's a very gruesome. It's an experience that for 10 years after I came back from Vietnam, I couldn't sleep well. You know, I had very restless nights. I would have nightmares. But I got to tell you, but it made me a stronger person. In Vietnam, this is why I always talk about we're all Americans. You know, this is a set of politics. We politics and La Raza Unida and all the Chicano organizations were the impetus, opening doors for where we are today. And I truly believe in that. Because if you don't have the shock troops willing to go out front and knock on doors, start knocking down, it'll never happen. The status quo will always be the same. When you bring about change, you're going to make people feel uncomfortable. In Vietnam, at a very young age, I got to be a squad leader. But it's interesting because I volunteered, you know, that's what I wanted to do, and when I went out there, I just didn't know any better, but once I got into it, I had no other choice. When they gave me the rifle, the real bullets, I said, oh my God, this thing is for real, man. And in Vietnam, I remember my guys, you know, I had a guy, his name was Anzio, Huap, Italian, from New York. I had two hillbillies from West Virginia. I had a son of a preacher, blue eye, out of Alabama. I had Suarez Wetback, you know, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but just being, you know, the way it was at the time, you know, not to be politically incorrect. Suarez, he was in the Marine Corps, my point guy. I had another Suarez out of LA, the Chicano of LA. Two brothers, black brothers out of Chicago. I had Shellhorn, a redneck bronco rider out of New Mexico. We all bonded, you know, we were there as Americans, you know, we were there as Marines, Semper Fi. And it's very interesting because we were family. You know, we protected each other. We lived with each other out in the jungles. We ate sea rations. Very unique experience. I was involved in about half a dozen combat operations. When I was with the Vietnamese people, I respected the homes. I ate with them, fish heads, whatever they ate, I ate. I figured if they didn't kill them, they were going to kill me. But it helped us in getting their trust.
I don't know about that fish soup. That's pretty tough to put down the stomach. I know. Get past the smell.
That's right. And it's very interesting that when we came back from Vietnam, we were treated like, I don't know, man. We're not treated very well when I came back from Vietnam. But Vietnam experience was there. I mean, it made me give me a strong appreciation for our country, you know, especially for my family and my community. But I, you know, at that time, I didn't question the politics behind it. As I look at the back, I got a different perspective. But in actual combat, we got to take care of each other. Troops. All my brothers have gone to the military. Desert Storm. One of my brothers, a paratrooper. One went airborne. Another one was in the Navy. Another one in the Army. So we all have done our duty in providing our service to our country in the military. It's why I get very much offended by some of the redneck Republican right wingers when they want to call us wetbacks or traitors. I'm not a wetback or a traitor. I never awarded the draft like some of them did. And came back, you know, and I was very motivated. You know, just that's who I am. And then after that, you know, when I was in law school at Georgetown, that was a different experience for me. One of the best law schools in the country. We had students from Harvard, from Yale, from Seattle, from UCLA, from Miami, and I felt out of place. I said, my God, what am I doing here? Sharp people. I think I had a nervous breakdown my first semester. You know, I was like in that daze. I could not keep up with the work. And at times I felt like quitting. I missed my family. I missed El Valle de la Raza. I mean, there's no Mexican food over there at that time. I missed, I just missed home. And it was hard for me to keep up. I mean, these people were the elite, you know, the cream of the crop. And there I was, the Bolero del Valle, you know, trying to compete with them. It was tough. But I was embarrassed. I said, I'm going to be embarrassed if I quit. What am I going to tell my friends? That I gave up. And I refused to give up. And there were about 7-8 other Chicanos there. And we continued to form study groups, and we worked, pushed, worked, and we can't quit. And during Christmas, my first year there, I did not want to come back to the Valley. So I knew if I came back to the Valley, I wouldn't want to go back to Washington, D.C. They're very different environment, very different environment. I had never been to Washington, D.C. until I went to law school. But I made it. It was tough. Once you make it to your first year, my second year, of course, you get a little bit more confident. And then by third year, I mean, you got a thick skin. One of the things that I do remember is me and this other guy took in debate. We do debate the last year against two girls from Alabama. Man, they kicked their butt. They were good debaters. But I learned a lot because I got to interact with the cream of the crop students. I was on the admissions committee. Just about everybody had a 4.0, 4.0, 4.0, 3.9, 3.9. Just super brains. But you know, it's not all it takes to be successful. You also have to have an understanding of life, common sense approach, what's right, what's wrong. Some of them have been babied their whole life. So this is why you need diversity in our universities and education. Because by mixing us together, we made them better students and better people, better citizens. They also made us better students, better people, better citizens. So it's a trade-off.
Any other comment you want to make about anything we didn't touch on? Or?
Well, one thing that I would always tell people, stay away from negative people. People that say no. You always got to be positive. Never think, well, this can't be done, this can't be done. I always think, how am I going to do it? And push, have the energy and the drive to get things done. You always have to have a plan of action in place. And nobody's going to come and give you things. Nobody's going to come to you and give it to you in a silver platter. You need to go out and get it. And you'd be surprised how many people are willing to help you reach your goals. As long as they know that you want to do it. Que traes ganas, traes ánimo, they will help you. And this comes from all walks of life. It doesn't make a difference if you're gringo, black, Hispanic, whatever. I mean, to me, we're just one community. And it is up to you to get things done. Nobody's going to do it for you.
Senator, thank you for all your time under the conditions that we're in.
Well, you know, it's kind of dark in here. It's getting darker and darker, you know, but